Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On Monday, the Taliban took the northern Afghan city of Kunduz. For 3 days since, Afghan forces, with some U.S. air support, have tried to take the city back. So far, they have failed. The Taliban is holding the first major city it's taken since 2001. Afghanistan's unity government in Kabul is struggling to respond. U.S. forces are scheduled to be gone by the end of 2016. This hour on Point, what now for Afghanistan and the United States? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is this deja vu all over again? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's the sound of the Taliban coming in, things beginning to come apart. BBC's Haroon Najafizadeh on Monday reporting from Afghanistan on the attack and takeover of the city of Kunduz.
The reports we have from Kunduz is that they have entered the city and they have raised their flag in some part of the city. There's been some, you know, resistance from the security forces of Afghanistan, but it's still the fighting goes on. There are hundreds of Taliban fighters, some from regional insurgency groups, who are assisting the Taliban in their Kunduz assault.
And in they came. Out went the Central Army. Here's Afghan National Army Lieutenant General Ali Murad. Was first hopeful on the situation there, interpreted by the BBC.
We have had an emergency security meeting tonight. Right now we are controlling the situation in Kunduz province, and we have already prepared ourselves to change the current situation in the city.
Control, change the situation? No, they have not. And here's a clip from a video that Taliban fighters have posted to social media soon after they took control in Kunduz, interpreted by the BBC.
God willing, this is our hope. We want to build a religious school, a bridge, a road, a Sharia-based government. This is why we came out, and this is what we fought for, so that Sharia law is enforced here.
And now, what's going on? Let's go to Afghanistan. Margarita Stankari joins us, Kabul bureau reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Margarita, what is the latest out of Kunduz? It's evening there as we speak. What's happened today? Have the central government forces made progress or lost ground?
Hi, Tom. Well, to answer your question, no, government forces have not made any progress. Since the beginning of the day, they've been saying that they would try to clear the city, but what's actually happened is that they lost one major stronghold, which was a hill called Bala Hisar, and they're mostly holed up in the airport together with some American troops who are there to help them. Part of the reason why they haven't received any reinforcements is because the Taliban now control most of the road leading out of Kunduz city. And in the neighboring province of Bagram, they are currently fighting Afghan troops who are trying to reach Kunduz. So most of these reinforcements are now stuck in Bagram province. So it's been a devastating day for Afghan troops, despite the support they're receiving from their American allies.
Margarita, what do we know about what's going on inside Kunduz at this point?
Inside Kunduz, it's relatively quiet because there is not much fighting happening right now. Afghan troops have tried to move back to the hill that they've lost, and there's some indications that they've succeeded. However, the troops that were stationed there before, many of them have actually surrendered to the Taliban, and the majority of the other Afghan forces are in the airport. So it's relatively quiet in the city itself, although there's fighting around the airport. There's Taliban fighting Afghan forces, and U.S. military has assisted them with at least three airstrikes since yesterday morning.
What about those airstrikes? And you mentioned U.S. troops. Where have the airstrikes been targeted, and what U.S. troops are on the scene?
The airstrikes have not been in the actual city for obvious reasons, because it's a heavily populated area. So the airstrikes, two of them have been close to the airport, which is where most, which has emerged as the front line, so to speak, of the fight at the moment. There's also coalition special forces advisors inside the airport. They include U.S. special forces troops. And very early this morning, overnight, they actually engaged in direct combat with the Taliban, which happens very rarely these days because U.S. forces are mostly advising and assisting their Afghan allies.
Kabul sounded very confident, at least articulated confidence, in the early hours after Kunduz was taken over. They have not managed to take it back quickly. What are the prospects for them taking the city back? And what about the political ramifications in Kabul of all of this turmoil in the north?
It's an absolute blow to the government. No one saw this coming. Obviously, Afghan forces didn't see it coming, and nor did their American allies. So politically, I think even if the Afghan troops managed to recapture Kunduz, it will be very difficult for the government to recover. Militarily, the main challenge is that this is a city, so it's densely populated, so this restricts the use of, say, heavy artillery or airstrikes in the city, and also the Taliban use the homes of civilians as shelter, and for the most part, they just look like ordinary Afghans. So if there's an operation in the city, it's going to be very difficult for the government to separate the enemy just from the civilians. So it's going to be really difficult for the government to recapture the city. Also, there are some indications that the Taliban seem determined to make Kunduz city their new stronghold. As we said before, they're controlling many of the roads leading to the city, and there's also some indications that more Taliban fighters are arriving to Kunduz. And this is also symbolically significant because in 2001, during the U.S.-led invasion, Kunduz was actually one of the very last enclaves to fall to American troops from the Taliban. So it was the last place the Taliban controlled when they were ousted in 2001.
And now 2015, the Taliban in control, the central government, at least so far, not able to take the city back. Margarita Stankati covering all that for the Wall Street Journal out of Kabul, joining us today from Jalalabad. Margarita, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
It is a name that resonates, Kunduz, all the way back. Many may remember in November of 2001, as Margarita says, it was the last city to fall. We were covering at that time, 14 years ago, the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks and the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. I spoke at that time with NPR's Steve Inskeep, who was in Afghanistan, about the situation in Kunduz. How does the siege of Kunduz fit into the overall picture of the conflict in Afghanistan now? Are there other holdout spots where the Taliban is still dug in?
Well, it seems to really get down to Kunduz and Kandahar, and maybe in a few weeks we will feel like things look differently. But other than those two places, the Northern Alliance appears to be consolidating its control in the country.
Who would have thought that we'd be here in 2015? Joining me now from Washington, Stephen Biddle, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, professor of political science, international affairs at George Washington University. Stephen Biddle, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And from Monterey, California, Thomas Johnson joins us, professor, director of the Program for Culture and Conflict Studies at the Naval Postgraduate School. Thomas Johnson, welcome back to you as well.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. It's good to be here.
Stephen Biddle, what are we learning from the events of this week in Kunduz?
Well, I think we're learning that what had been the kind of upper bound reasonable projection for the outcome in the war, that the Afghan forces would sustain a stalemate until some sort of negotiated settlement could be reached, is less probable than we thought. There's still some chance, depending on what happens in coming weeks and months in Kunduz, that the situation will stabilize, Afghan security forces will hold, and we can get back to the process of trying to restart a now stalled negotiating agenda. On the other hand, if the counteroffensive into Kunduz goes badly, it's not inconceivable the Afghan National Security Forces could break countrywide. This is a very big deal. I mean, the pessimistic reasonable projections until fairly recently were always that perhaps the Taliban would control the countryside, but they would have a great deal of difficulty taking a major city. They've now done that. So I think what that does is it should suggest, I think, to the United States that it's time to change assessments of what the upper bound looks like and what's achievable.
Thomas Johnson, we don't want to make too much of what is now a 3-day setback, and yet this is a big tell. What do you see in this Kunduz situation?
Well, I think this is very significant along a wide variety of issues. I mean, offensive urban warfare takes a lot of backbone, a lot of grim determination, and a lot of casualties, usually 6-1 in favor of the defender. It's important to recognize that the Taliban initially invaded the city with about 500 fighters late in the morning, Monday. And according to the New York Times, the Afghan National Security Forces had 7,000 members in the city. So with a numerical advantage of 14-1 defending urban terrain, I like to think of sort of Stalingrad and Fallujah.
Yeah.
The ANSF managed to put up less than 12 hours of resistance. It's been reported that police officers, the AMP stationed in Kunduz, simply abandoned their posts, and most of the ANA ended up at the airport. But I think the ANA has not been trained for urban fighting. They've been trained to fight in rural areas. This is clearly a very densely populated area, and I am very pessimistic at the chance for the ANA to take back the city anytime soon without heavy U.S. presence.
Stephen Biddle, do you see the prospect of heavy U.S. presence there? We just heard from Margarita Stancati in Afghanistan that there are U.S. Special Forces is now doing some on-the-ground fighting, I think she said, alongside the Afghan troops. Might more of that come? I mean, the combat role is supposed to be over.
Yeah, and there's a lot that we don't know, obviously, about what American special forces were doing in Kunduz. I mean, if I had to take a random guess, I'd say probably they were there to direct airstrikes and got caught up in a close-range action that they hadn't anticipated. Mm-hmm. I don't expect multiple brigades of American infantry to be assaulting Kunduz anytime soon. I think airstrikes are the upper bound on what we'll see.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the Taliban back front and center in Afghanistan and the meaning of the fall of Kunduz and whether the U.S. should stay on track for its exit. Nearly 10,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan now. They are scheduled more or less to be out by the end of next year. But this week, well, here's the sound of Taliban fighters on Monday firing weapons and yelling in the streets of Kunduz. November 2001, it was a different story. It was U.S.-led troops and troops headed in. Here was Steve Inskeep. We talked to him there on the outskirts of Kunduz, talking to a boy named Fahim, who had witnessed fighting.
A lot of people, Afghan, were killed in the battle.
You saw people killed?
Yes. It was war.
It was war. Stephen Biddle joins us, senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations, professor at George Washington University from Washington Today, and Thomas Johnson, professor, director of the Program for Culture and Conflict Studies at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. I want to ask the two of you about leadership in Kabul looking out on this. Here was President Ashraf Ghani yesterday saying that security forces had made gains in their effort to regain control of Kunduz. Steve Biddle, Thomas Johnson, he's saying Afghan security forces have made achievements today in Kunduz province, recaptured parts of government buildings, new reinforcements have reached Kunduz and Beglan, the hilltop that ultimately fell. A battalion from the National Army will get to Kunduz soon. Stephen Biddle, as far as you know, how much of that is true?
Well, I mean, again, reports are contradictory. Now, The basic outlines of the situation, though, in light of the kind of majority of what different voices are saying, is that the majority of the counterattack forces that the Afghans would like to bring to bear in Kunduz have had a very difficult time getting there because they're moving by ground, and the Taliban control a lot of the districts surrounding Kunduz and, for that matter, much of the province to its south. So if you can't get there by helicopter, as, for example, American Special Forces can, and as a small relatively small number of Afghan commandos can. The bulk of the ground forces that are eventually going to enter the city, and all we hope, are moving there by ground, and they've got to move through areas that are heavily infested with IEDs and are subject to ambush. And it's going to be a while before they even get to Kunduz. Now, as Tom pointed out earlier, the Afghan National Army has not had a lot of experience in offensive urban warfare. So even when they get to Kunduz, the business of conducting what would be a challenging military operation for anybody, including us for that matter, you know, this is an operation that will be conducted in a city where the population is still there and hundreds of thousands of them. That, you know, whatever you think happened in the last 12 hours, a bit better, a bit worse, do we hold this hill? Have we lost this hill? Mm-hmm. What's the situation in the airport? The prognosis for the coming weeks and months is this is going to be an extremely difficult campaign.
How, Thomas Johnson, how can that be true when the Taliban, I mean, the understanding for a long time has been, and Kabul has been saying the last day or two, they're based in Pakistan. And Pakistan's a long way from Kunduz. If the government has trouble with supply lines to Kunduz, how's the Taliban pulling this off?
Well, as Stephen suggested, the Taliban control much of the province of Kunduz. And this shouldn't really come to a surprise to many. In fact, many are criticizing Ghani. In fact, people called for his impeachment yesterday because the Taliban had been surrounding Kunduz for the last 2 months. They had actually taken a district center in the province of Kunduz a few months ago and lost it. So there were clear warnings and suggestions that the Taliban were going to move on to Kunduz. So I think Ghani, who's not very popular in the country right now, only about 20% according to the latest poll suggests a favorable rating of him, is in big trouble. Abdullah, addressing the United Nations last Sunday, suggested in a couple of different instances that the unity government in Afghanistan might be in trouble. And I think this is going to really lead to the downfall of the unity government that presently exists in Kabul if the ANA can't retake the city. And like I said earlier, I think that it's going to be very, very difficult for the ANA to retake Kunduz.
The Pentagon yesterday, Press Secretary Peter Cook expressing confidence in Afghanistan's security forces despite the loss of Kunduz.
Obviously, this is a setback for the Afghan security forces, but we've seen them respond in recent weeks and months to the challenges they faced, and they're doing the same thing in Kunduz right now.
Stephen Biddle, we want to be careful here in these characterizations. Americans have become cynical maybe, and maybe justifiably so. I mean, we saw the Iraqi forces collapse so completely in Mosul and elsewhere. We have seen the so-called moderate opposition in Syria trained up at $500 million expense by the U.S. just go nowhere. But the Afghan central forces have been in a fairly stiff conflict with the Taliban for, what, the better part of a year, more or less on their own, and they seem to have done better than the others, have they not?
Well, they've certainly outperformed the Iraqi army in Mosul last year. And they have mostly held their ground. Again, partly what's so interesting about Kunduz is that this is a very different event than what we've seen before. By and large, the Afghan National Security Forces have not been able to expand the government's zone of control, but neither have they lost very much, at least more than in a short-term temporary sort of way. Now, that said, I think there's a systematic tendency among Americans, both in the government and for that matter, the policy community, to tend to exaggerate what we can do in terms of improving the military capability of indigenous allies in places like Iraq or like Afghanistan through the provision of training and equipment. That's not to say that we can't do anything. Again, the Afghan National Security Forces are not simply a thoroughgoing catastrophe, but neither are they the kind of military force that you might expect if you just looked at the amount of money that's been spent and you look at the number of advisors that have been working with them. And I think the underlying problem here in American assessments of what allies can be made to do is that we tend to look at this as a problem of material capacity, giving them training, giving them equipment, increasing their numbers. Whereas at the end of the day, an awful lot of the military potential of an indigenous ally in places like Afghanistan or elsewhere is political. It has to do with what the local society and government thinks is the purpose of the military forces. And it's often not what Americans think is the purpose of them. Americans think that these are institutions that exist to go defeat foreign enemies. And if you give them enough equipment, they'll go do that. In societies like Afghanistan or Iraq or Somalia or Yemen or lots of other places we care about at the moment, militaries have a much more complicated role that has a much more important internal domestic political component than we suppose, and that can significantly affect their ability to bring about results on the ground that we want.
Thomas Johnson, for many years, Americans were told, we have to secure Afghanistan. Look at 9/11. If we let it go, it'll become the Wild West again and produce who knows what. This is not a something that we can walk away from, that we can lose. I mean, if we cut through here, and maybe they'll battle back, maybe they'll get on top of this, but I'm hearing pretty loud and clear that maybe they won't, and the U.S. is scheduled to be out. What does that mean for American security and for the timetable? Right now, U.S. withdrawal is scheduled for the end of 2016. We're already down to 9,800 troops. Does that add up? Should we just go anyway? And does that mean it's going to be Taliban Afghanistan again?
Well, I think you ask a very interesting question. I think it's important to note that there's never been a Taliban that has attacked the United States in a terrorist fashion outside of Afghanistan. The Taliban were not involved. Afghans were not involved in 9/11.
But the chaos Taliban, there bred the Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda directed the attacks.
That's absolutely correct. And in fact, there's real scholarly debates on how close the Taliban were to Al-Qaeda. Mullah Omar was clearly close to bin Laden, but there were so-called moderate Taliban in the late, in 2001, that wanted to actually give bin Laden over to the United States. So there's always been questions on how much control Al-Qaeda had over the Taliban. I personally believe they had very little control over the Taliban. The Taliban, in many respects, are Pashtun nationalists that just want foreigners out. When I get on an airplane in San Francisco, I surely don't worry about a Taliban terrorist taking down the plane.
Are you suggesting by that looking forward, the United States could work with the Taliban and not worry about a repeat of the chaos that, whether they coordinated it or not, did give a breeding ground to Al-Qaeda? Maybe that's secondary now. You've got ISIS and everything else going on.
Well, I first of all, don't believe that we can ever negotiate with the Taliban. I mean, Mullah Omar and Mullah Mansour, his replacement, have recently suggested they wouldn't even consider negotiating until international forces have left Afghanistan. And that's been a point that Mullah Omar made for 10 years. So I don't think that negotiations are going to lead anywhere. But I do think that the Afghans are very pragmatic people. And I think that once international forces are removed totally from the country, that the Afghans will come up with their own solution.
So are you saying get out?
Well, I think that after spending $1 trillion and a lot of blood and treasure, I think that from a strategic perspective, Afghanistan was never a winnable war. We've had many, many politicians, military folks, and analysts that have tried to wish reality onto Afghanistan, and they've been wrong time and time again. I have faith that the Afghans will be able to settle this eventually under their own terms. And I think that trying to increase U.S. ground forces, for example, in light of what's happening in Kunduz would be a major mistake and just prolong the war and more casualties.
Thomas Johnson at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, please stand by. And Stephen Biddle at George Washington University. Michael O'Hanlon joins us right now from the Brookings Institution, Director of Foreign Policy Research there. Michael O'Hanlon, welcome back to On Point.
Well, greetings, everyone. Nice to be with you all.
14 years of U.S. involvement, $1 trillion, a lot dead, and now we see Kunduz falling, and Thomas Johnson at the Naval Postgraduate School says, enough already, let's get out. They'll work it out. Let's go. It's unwinnable.
Well, no, I don't agree with Tom on that point. Who knows what's winnable and what's not, and if that's even the right word. I think, however, that at a time when most of Afghanistan's major cities and roads are clearly in government control, and we've seen one setback in the last 48 hours in Kunduz, this is not the time to decide that somehow the whole thing is lost. It makes a big difference whether there is one major city or one mid-sized city in Taliban hands versus the entire country. It makes a big difference whether the entire momentum of this conflict is seen to shift in such a way that The broader Al-Qaeda ISIL narrative will be somehow used or reinforced by this development. I agree with Tom's point that the Taliban themselves are not Al-Qaeda or ISIL, but they are linked. And the broader movement here is unfortunately doing a lot better than we would like. There are no clean, easy solutions, but that doesn't mean that we should start abandoning a situation where there are 300,000 reasonably well-trained troops. As Steve Biddle has said correctly, the politics are not always going to be favorable to how they're used, but they are generally in support of the government in Afghanistan. We've spent a lot of time helping prepare them. There is a national unity government that is doing struggling, but holding together, that is certainly unified in wanting to destroy or at least fend off the Taliban. Now, I see no reason to declare this the moment to give up.
Tom Johnson, one city down, don't cut and run. With everything else that's going okay, says Michael O'Hanlon. What do you say?
Well, I just don't agree with Michael. Kunduz is the sixth largest city in Afghanistan, has over 300,000 people. We don't control, the ANA does not control the lines of communication. I would challenge Steve to get in the car and try to drive around the Ring Road.
Around Kabul itself, around the capital.
Well, I'm talking about the Ring Road that connects the major
cities
in Afghanistan.
Through the entire country of Afghanistan, all right.
But even Kabul is a very dangerous position right now. And I think the actual strength of the Afghan National Security Forces has been continually overestimated. There was a recent report published by the Army War College that suggested that the ANA has about 130,000 troops that are present and ready for duty. What we have been reporting, what the Pentagon has been reporting for years, is the number of troops that have actually gone through training. And the Afghan National Police in many parts of the country are the most hated institution because they're an extractive organization. As I mentioned earlier, the reports in Kunduz were that the AMP immediately left their posts after the Taliban attacked the city. So I think that, and again, considering that they haven't been trained for urban warfare, I think this is a very, very big deal. And I don't think we can estimate it. Again, a lot of people want to wish reality onto Afghanistan, and they've been proven wrong time and time again.
Steve Biddle, I've driven that ring road from Kabul to Kandahar to Herat. Would you do that today? And what about U.S. staying in or getting out? I mean, we've talked in the past. You've said, we're not going to make the kind of commitment that it would take, so better to go.
Well, I mean, as far as driving the Ring Road, pretty countryside, a lot of potholes. I mean, there are parts of it you can drive. There are parts of it that have not been a particularly safe place for a long time.
Yeah.
So, the aggregate assessment of what's going on in the country, it seems to me, again, has been that we've seen a stalemate since the United States military presence started to draw down. And the question now is, does Kunduz signal something other than a continuation of that stalemate or not? I really don't think there's any taste in Washington, as I sense it right now, for simply cutting and running at the moment. I think a lot of people, though, are going to look at the campaign in Kunduz and whether or not similar things happen in other cities over the next coming weeks and months. And the administration is going to make some sort of assessment of between now and the end of 2016. Are they going to change the current policy, which still, as we speak, is to go down to a token embassy presence by the end of the year? Are they going to accelerate that? If Kunduz collapses, if it spreads to other cities, if the Afghan National Security Forces and institutions split, I think there's a significant chance that the drawdown will accelerate.
John McCain and others say you got to get off the calendar-based drawdown here. They're signaling too much to the Taliban. They know the U.S. wants to be out by the end of 2016. President Obama has promised that by the end of his presidency, but he doesn't want to end his presidency with a Saigon scenario. Should we stick with the calendar, Steve?
Well, I thought calendar deadlines have been a dreadful idea forever, really. I mean, independent of how many troops you think should be there, the idea that you're going to set a calendar deadline for drawdowns is terrible. That for a long, long time, really ever since the Obama administration took office, the end game to this war, if it turns out well, has been some sort of negotiated settlement. Every time you set a calendar deadline, you just delay serious talks until after the deadline as the Taliban wait to see if they can profit from the deadline without having to negotiate.
But without a deadline, it feels like you're there forever without a deadline. And Tom Johnson says Taliban won't talk until we're out.
Well, I mean, the Taliban have already been talking. There have been two negotiations held in the last year. It's stalled at the moment.
Yeah.
But the idea that the Taliban just won't talk, there's a lot of empirical evidence to suggest the other side of that.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Taliban back front and center in Afghanistan and the meaning of the fall this week of Kunduz, major city in the north-northeast of Afghanistan. First one Taliban has taken since 14 years ago when American troops came in. We're looking at whether the U.S. will, should stay on track for its exit, how to handle it. Stephen Biddle is with us from George Washington University, Michael O'Hanlon from the Brookings Institution, Thomas Johnson in Monterey, California, at the Naval Postgraduate School. Washington talking supportive. Here was the White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest on Air Force One yesterday.
The United States, Afghanistan's neighbors, and our international partners will continue to strongly support Afghan President Ghani and the National Unity Government to improve Afghanistan's security, continue to target terrorists, and preserve the gains we have made together.
But it's a tough challenge with the Taliban now dug in residential areas of Kunduz. They've been ransacking offices there, blew up a big vault in the middle of town. They're in the middle of the population. Here's the president, Ashraf Afghani, yesterday accusing them of using civilians as human shields. They're using them as human shields, civilians. The government's responsible, cannot bomb its own citizens. But I want to assure all my countrymen that Kunduz is under our management. Well, not really. And then you've got this unity government, Abdullah alongside Ghani. That has been awkward. Here he is blaming Pakistan for the Taliban attack.
The presence of terrorist sanctuaries and support networks in Pakistan continue to cause trouble inside Afghanistan.
Abdullah at the UN General Assembly on Monday. Of course, Taliban is in much of the country, inside the country as well. David's calling from New York. David, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi, the panel. I agree with the analysis of Steve Biddle and Thomas Johnson about the failure of the U.S. project in Afghanistan, really at every level, and its larger implications for strategy and policy. But isn't the West's commitment more than just the military forces that it could somehow dismantle, even if the strategy and politics could somehow be altered in Washington? Aren't we committed to this struggle with much more than troops? In the first instance, all sorts, an army of trainers and police, possibly, a lot of contractors. I don't know, and I wonder if the panel could address that. And secondly, more importantly, is the United States or maybe the West not funding the entire Afghan military effort in the country and really committed to doing so for the foreseeable future because the Afghanistan public national revenue is so small?
Yep. Let us pick it all up. Steve Biddle, first to you. What about the full profile of the NATO/American commitment in Afghanistan, troops, trainers, contractors, and very importantly, funding?
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. mission in Afghanistan has long had three components to it: security, which is mostly military, governance reform, which is military and civilian, and economic development, which is mostly civilian and a little bit military. So it's always been more than just troops and combat. What happens, though, as the U.S. military presence goes down and as security in rural areas gets worse, is our ability to do economic development and governance reform tends to decline as well. So it's very hard to build a school, train teachers, and keep the school running if you can't put security around the school to keep the Taliban from chasing the teachers away and blowing up the building. Mm. So to some extent, these things decline together if security declines. The David makes an extremely good point with respect to the funding of the Afghan National Security Forces, however. I mean, the fiscal year 13 operating budget of the Afghan National Security Forces was twice the entire domestic revenue of the entire Afghan government. I mean, prior to Kunduz, my assessment of the situation has long been that the primary threat to success of the mission has been that the outside funding for the Afghan National Security Forces would not survive long enough for the negotiations to come to fruition, and the stalemate would
Congress
break for that reason.
Congress would not keep infusing the cash, you mean?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. But there may be other challenges depending on the performance of the ANSF in coming weeks in Kunduz, but the other funding challenge remains. I mean, it is clear that the Afghan government cannot pay for a military large enough to sustain a stalemate. That money has got to come from outside, and that requires serious political effort in Western capitals to keep those funds flowing.
They've got record opium harvests there now. That turns into heroin by the time it gets to the streets of the West, but I guess that money doesn't go into government pockets. Michael O'Hanlon, what would you do when it comes to troop levels, timetables, and then all the other support that's been there for Afghanistan, up to and including that big number, money?
I would keep probably 5,000 to 7,000 U.S. troops indefinitely. I'd abandon any talk of a timetable. I'd stop portraying the U.S. presence as just a favor we're doing to Afghanistan. I'd also describe it as a benefit that we've gotten from an investment that, as you pointed out earlier, has been huge and perhaps very discouraging in the payoff, and yet still has, at the moment at least, produced a country that the major cities and major roads are more held by the government than certainly anybody else, and where we have the need to keep focusing on watching and sometimes attacking al-Qaeda or possibly ISIL, and therefore having some counterterrorism-oriented bases that can also help the Afghan army now and again and help train them, I think is a benefit for American security. And I don't think we should be on the defensive in saying so or always saying, well, how fast can we get out or get rid of it? I think 5,000 to 7,000 U.S. troops indefinitely is the right way to think about it.
Tom Johnson, sunk costs are sunk, even if it's $1 trillion in sunk costs. Maybe it's worth 5,000 to 7,000 troops stay in there as a kind of cork in the bottle to not let the whole investment go. What do you say to that perspective?
Well, we need to protect the embassy. So I agree with Michael that we need to keep some troops in country. But, you know, we have spent near $1 trillion in Afghanistan. Corruption runs rampant from the cobbler in any city to the president's office. We tried to do nation building. It's important to, and we failed miserably. It's important to recognize that about 97% of the gross domestic product of Afghanistan comes from donations and foreign aid. When we left,
wow.
most of our forces left Afghanistan, tens of thousands of Afghans lost their employment who were working on forward operating bases. It's estimated right now that 45% unemployment in the country. So in many respects, it's the economy, stupid. They had a fiscal crisis last fall where they couldn't even pay their government employees. I absolutely agree with Stephen Biddle that they can't afford to pay for the type of security forces that we've built in our own image. They've also had fiscal crisis this year. So I think that economically the country's in very, very tough situation. And I don't think that any type of I don't think there's much that we can do with that. I think the American public and Congress has lost patience with the money that we've been giving.
Steve Biddle, you wrote 2 years ago, and we talked about it on this show, that there isn't, though, actually a viable path that's not really in and not really out. You know, you said you got to kind of cut your losses, I think, or get all the way out and with no presence left behind, or to negotiate the way out of this. Is there, if that doesn't succeed, is there a leave 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 troops there and keep muddling along path that's viable?
If you don't have some sort of strategy for a negotiated settlement that makes sense, then just keeping troops there, you know, however many, however long, is just wasted money. or it delays the inevitable. I suppose you could make an argument that for humanitarian reasons, delaying the inevitable might have some benefit, but marginal. I'm not a big fan of Goldilocks solutions. I mean, Karl von Clausewitz, 19th century military philosopher, is famous for saying no one trying to cross a wide chasm would begin by jumping halfway. I understand the temptation. The administration and many Americans have long felt that we had some interests in Afghanistan, but not existential ones, and therefore we ought to spend something kind of commensurate with the scale of the interests. That tends to produce expensive failure rather than cheap failure, and therefore my instinct is to either decide that you're going to bite the bullet, our interests aren't existential, but they're worth fighting for, and therefore we're going to do what it takes, not 500,000 soldiers, but we're going to do what it takes to get a settlement we can live with, or we're going to cut our losses and get out. What's happened over time is that what going all in looks like is beginning smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller in terms of what the market will bear politically in Washington. Now, we're getting close to the point at which the upper bound on what you could imagine a continued effort looking like is so small that what you can get out of it is so limited that it's no longer worth carrying on. I'm at the moment still in favor of trying to pursue a settlement and hoping that the Afghan security forces can hold a stalemate long enough to do that. I think at the moment the upper bound that is associated with that plan is some, as far as the troop count goes, which I think is the least important part of it, keep something like the current 9,800. The more important part of it at the moment is A, keep the Afghan security forces funded, and B, increase the tempo of U.S. airstrikes and free them from this kind of silly political constraint, this fiction that at the moment we're flying airstrikes only to protect American troops in theater, and allow us to do air support on behalf of the Afghan National Security Forces to make it harder for the Taliban to concentrate these multi-hundred soldier formations that have been so hard for the Afghans to handle when they've attacked isolated outposts or recently a major city. I'm still in favor of trying to do that. But eventually the prognosis gets bad enough to where throwing good money after bad no longer makes sense. For my part, this is a value judgment, and lots of people will disagree. Some will agree. Mm. For my part, with my value judgment, it's still worth that kind of upper bound to try and get a compromise settlement that's better than nothing. But that position isn't sustainable intellectually indefinitely. And if things continue to go badly, and especially, again, if the prognosis after Kunduz looks bad rather than good.
Michael O'Hanlon, let me come to you. Let's say we stick with the schedule. President Obama promised he'd have the country out of there. He doesn't want, I'm sure, to look like a fiasco on the way out. But let's say we stick with it. And given what we're seeing right now, what scenario or scenarios do you envision?
Well, I think it's going to be likely that you'll see more of what we've been seeing this week, and a lower likelihood of the Kunduz attack being reversed. And so I'm strongly against that plan. The one thing I would add, I think most of what Steve just said I agree with, but there is one other perspective that I would add in, which is that I think we Americans are actually sometimes a little more strategically patient than we give ourselves credit for. We stuck with South Korea for 30 years when they were not a democracy. We stuck with a number of other questionable allies during the Cold War, sometimes perhaps ones we shouldn't have. But nonetheless, we exhibited a certain amount of patience. We've done it in the Middle East with Egypt and Israel, for better and for worse, usually for worse. And so I think saying that there's only going to be a 1 or a 2 or a 5 year time commitment here that's possible in terms of American politics, to me, is not persuasive. I'm not putting those words in anybody's mouth. I'm just saying that some would argue that America's patience is running out. We know it from the poll numbers. Americans are not big on this conflict. We also know Americans don't like to lose. And if there's a modest ongoing investment that can give us some capability against al-Qaeda and ISIL and shore up the Afghan government, and by the way, I like Steve's idea of using our air power less apologetically for the foreseeable future, but I see no reason why this is unsustainable for the indefinite future. Now, if we're in the same place in 10 years and you have me back on then, maybe I'll have to acknowledge that it's time for a rethink.
We know it's costly. What's the downside of just going? Because that's the path we're on at this moment. What's the downside?
Well, you look at Syria and Iraq. I mean, there's no reason to think that Afghanistan and the tribal areas of Pakistan are invulnerable to that same kind of big takeover by an extremist force. Now, Tom Johnson was right to say the Taliban historically has not been that same kind of global anti-Western jihadist group, but it's affiliated or potentially sympathetic and in cahoots with a number that are. And they could certainly take advantage of territory that it might offer them. So, no, this is a broad, long-term struggle that we're going to face against al-Qaeda. al-Qaeda-ism. It's ongoing, and the notion that we can somehow choose to just exit that struggle, I think, is incorrect.
Tom Johnson, I read you saying you're pessimistic and we should go. If we do, what's the scenario that you envision?
Well, it's been reported that ISIL's in three-quarters of the provinces of Afghanistan right now. Not a large presence, but they have recruiters. In Nangarhar a couple of weeks ago, ISIL attacked Afghan National Police posts and killed a number of AMP members, and they declared war. ISIL has also declared war on the Taliban. So it's a very volatile situation, it seems to me.
But is that okay? You're saying we should go anyway? It's too costly? Well, we can accept that? Maybe even, you know, ISIL grows into Afghanistan?
Well, I think ISIL has its eyes on Afghanistan and Central Asia. Will they be successful? I don't know. I think it's way too early to tell, and we have to see a lot of dust settling before we can make any type of reasonable assessment of
that. But you would go and watch from afar as whatever happens, happens.
Well, I'm not sure how important Afghanistan is to American national security. Like it's been reported over this broadcast, I mean, you have not seen Taliban jihadists attacking Western interests outside of Afghanistan. I'm not worried about the Taliban becoming international jihadists.
But ISIL is already international, and they're already there.
I'm sorry?
ISIL's already international and is already there,
as
you say.
Yeah, ISIL's a different situation. Yeah. But, you know, I think that it's still too early to tell if they're going to be successful in Afghanistan. They have a rather small presence, but they are recruiting, like I suggested, in three-quarters of the provinces of Afghanistan.
Steve Biddle, if we go... Sorry, Tom. Steve, quickly, do you see negotiation breaking out and some kind of stability or, I don't know, fiery future?
If we go and our money goes, these negotiations have no prognosis because the Taliban has no reason to think they won't get the whole loaf without concession. I mean, a precondition for any chance of a negotiated settlement is at a minimum we have to keep funding the ANSAF. There are other things we can do like airstrikes and so forth that would help at the margin. But if we defund the ANSAF, the show's over.
Defund, show's over, stakes just as wide and large as they can be. Stephen Biddle at George Washington University, thank you so much for being with us today, Steve, as always.
My pleasure.
Michael O'Hanlon at the Brookings Institution, thank you for joining us, Michael.
Thank you, Tom.
And Thomas Johnson, Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. Thank you, Tom.
Well, thank you very much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.